New research about what causes autism shows that genes are very much involved, as is gender and the environment. This hour, why autism may be a very complex illness. Studies suggest genetic mutations may be to blame, disrupting the circuitry of the brain. But mysteries remain, like why it affects more boys than girls, why the age of the parents may determine risk. As for treatment, what are the options? How effective are they? And what works for your kids? Plus, playing around with antimatter trapped in a bottle, and the video pick of the week, growing hearts and bones in the lab. All coming up after this break, so stay with us.
Our goal is to keep these podcasts free. Here's how you can help.
You can support the show by trying GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Use GoToMeeting to bring people together, colleagues and clients across the country or around the world, to collaborate in real time. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and use the promo code SCIENCE.
Thank you, Anna. And now, on to the show.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, trying to overcome a bout of laryngitis, so see if you can hang in there with me for this program. Our current ideas about the universe say that when the universe was created in the Big Bang billions of years ago, not only was matter created, but so was matter's mirror image, antimatter. One of the great mysteries about the universe is, where did all the antimatter go? How come we don't see it anymore? And if you want to see it to study it, we have to create it in the laboratory. But when we do, it only lasts, so exists for a fraction of a second. Until now. Last November, researchers created and trapped antihydrogen, the simplest atom of antimatter, holding it in a magnetized bottle for only a fraction of a second. And now that same team is back and they've raised the bar, trapping antimatter for longer than ever before. This antihydrogen, around 16 minutes, just about as long as they wanted. So now, what do you do with it? Here to answer that question is Dr. Jeffrey Hengst. He's professor of physics at Aarhus University in Denmark. He's also the leader of the Alpha Collaboration at CERN in Geneva. Welcome back, Dr. Hengst.
Thank you, Ira. It's good to be back. I must be doing something right.
Well, what you've done is you've trapped antimatter for longer. For what, 16 minutes?
Yeah, 1,000 seconds is 16 minutes, give or take.
And could you have gone as long as you wanted to?
Well, we don't really know the limit yet. This was as long as we conducted the experiment and could get statistics enough to see the signal. This takes some time, of course, and we've seen some events at longer time, but we can't say 100% certain that they're above the background. So 1,000 seconds is firmly established, and we can continue to look for longer, but it's not our highest priority right now.
Talk about antihydrogen. How is it different than regular hydrogen?
Well, that's what we'd like to know. We'd like to measure the characteristics of antihydrogen and see if it's the same as hydrogen. The fundamental difference is, of course, that antihydrogen is made of antiparticles. So instead of a positive proton, you have a negative antiproton. Instead of an electron in hydrogen, you have a positron, an anti-electron. So that's the structure of the thing. The question is whether this thing obeys the same laws of physics as normal hydrogen. And that's what we're finally getting ready to measure.
Well, the fact that you were able to trap it in a magnetized bottle would not tell you something.
Well, the fact that we can trap it doesn't tell us too much yet. We need to take the next step, which is to shine light on it, both literally and figuratively. We'd like to interact with it, with its internal structure, to see what kind of color of light does it like to absorb, or what frequency of microwaves, for example, because we know those things very well for hydrogen. So the next thing, and the thing that many of us have been working for a long time, is to measure something about this thing.
Do the antiparticles conform to the other, for lack of better phraseology, laws of nature, like the regular particles, like gravitation, magnetism, things like that?
We know absolutely nothing about gravitation and antimatter as far as measurements are concerned. In fact, that's one of the exciting things about this new development, is that having them around for a while may allow us to do what we need to do to them to study their gravitational influence in the Earth's gravitational field. It's a very special experiment, antimatter in a matter gravitational field. We've never tried that before. It's an extremely difficult experiment. But more fundamentally, okay, we know that the antiproton has a charge that's very close to the proton, and that the positron has a charge that's very close to that of the electron in magnitude. They're opposite, of course. But we haven't been able to study a composite antimatter system like this with any kind of real precision. And that's what we'd like to do, because hydrogen is something we really understand very well in physics. So if we can do the same sort of things with antihydrogen, we can compare them.
And it's the most abundant element in the universe.
Hydrogen is, yes. Yeah. And antihydrogen is the least abundant element in the universe.
So where did it all go?
That's the question. You know, in physics, we like to think big. The paleontologists are missing a few dinosaurs and fossils along the way. We've misplaced half the universe, and we really don't know what happened to it. So as you pointed out, the Big Bang theory says that there should have been equal amounts of matter and antimatter at the beginning of the universe. And for some reason, only the matter survived. Of course, they can't be in the same place at the same time. We can't have both. But why couldn't we have an antimatter universe? That, as far as we understand today, that should have been equally probable. So we just don't know why nature chose one and not the other.
Hmm. And the first thing you'll be doing then is, if now that you've trapped it in the bottle, you say you would shine some laser light on it?
The first thing we'll actually do is microwaves.
Microwaves. Well,
you can think of these little atoms as magnets. They're trapped because they have a little magnetic moment, as we call it. They're like a small bar magnet, and that's trapped in this magnetic field. If you shine some microwaves of the right frequency on that atom, you can turn its magnet the other direction, and then it'll fall out of this trap and annihilate. And we can see that. Even just a single atom, if it comes out, we can detect it. So there, antimatter gives you kind of a detection bonus. It's easier to detect than matter when it annihilates. So that's what we'll do. We'll shine some microwaves on it and see if it likes the same frequencies that hydrogen would like. That would be the first test of this sort of symmetry between hydrogen and antihydrogen. It's not the most precise one, but it's a first step.
Mm-hmm. Some questions coming in from our listeners. On our Science Friday Facebook page, Daniel Yout would like to know about whether the antihydrogen could be the start of a new periodic table.
Well, that's an excellent question. In fact, it's a timely question, because very recently in the Brookhaven National Laboratory at the Rick Accelerator, a group created anti-helium nuclei in collisions of very heavy ions. But that's very, very difficult, and they don't produce them in a way that you could catch them. They just demonstrated that anti-helium nuclei, that's number two on the anti-periodic table, that they exist. But there's really no chance of doing what we do to make an anti-helium atom. So these things just existed a little bit in a collision and then ran into some material. So it's very, very, very unlikely. I'd say impossible to make anti-helium atoms and try to study them.
But you could make a new periodic table. We make these little, high-level particles that last for a fraction of a second. Wouldn't you have to start?
That's right. We believe that there is an anti-periodic table, right? That you could have an anti-universe full of anti-elements. But it's very difficult for us to go and do atomic physics on those. So you can demonstrate so far that we've got two of them.
And how difficult is it to go up then and create new elements, anti-elements?
Well, we say it the Brookhaven paper, it takes about a factor of 1,000 every time you want to add one mass. So going from hydrogen to deuterium, right, that's a proton and a neutron, you'll get 1,000 times less deuterons for the same type of interaction. So that's 1,000 for every one. So you can see it gets really, really unlikely very quickly to get anything heavier. So I think you can just forget that and hope that we can find something with antihydrogen.
Let's go to the phones. David in St. Louis. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, you talk about the annihilation when the matter meets the antimatter, and I was reading about this week, and I was wondering, does this interaction obey the laws that we think of, like the conservation of mass and energy? Like in a nuclear reaction, you'll lose mass, but you'll gain energy. What happens when these two, what exactly do you mean by annihilation? Thanks.
Yeah, that's a good question. What happens exactly is that the quarks in the antiproton annihilate with quarks in a nucleus in the material. And that produces energy for just a very fleeting moment. And what happens in practice is that energy quickly becomes mass again. So that's Einstein, E equals MC squared. This energy that goes into the annihilation quickly generates new mass. And this mass is in the form of subatomic particles we call pions. And they come screaming out of our apparatus, and we can measure them. So as far as we know, these annihilation events obey conservation of mass and energy. Mm-hmm. And no one's ever seen any kind of deviation from that. But the energy quickly becomes mass that flies out, and we can measure.
And now that you've proven you can hold on to these particles long enough to get a good look at them, after you do your microwave experiment, what's the next? Is there a better detector you're working on?
Now, the next thing, you want to keep making more and more precise measurements, right? The thing about atomic physics is atomic physicists are the guys who really know how to measure things precisely. So, for example, the energy of the 1-to-2 transition, we call it in hydrogen, from the ground state to the first excited state, is known to 1 part in 10 to the 14, approximately. Right? That's 0.0141 in precision. So in order to do the best test, you'd like to repeat that experiment in antihydrogen. And that requires lasers, a very special laser system. So starting next year, we hope, we'll be able to shine lasers on the antihydrogen that's in the trap and start seeing that it wants exactly the same color as hydrogen. That's a figuratively color because the light that we're going to use is invisible.
Mm-hmm. And one last question, about a minute that we have left. I'll see as many questions as I can get in. How do you make antimatter?
Well, this, again, it's all up to Einstein. CERN uses energy from a particle accelerator to create new things, right? That's what they're looking for when they're searching for the Higgs boson. They're using a very high-energy particle accelerator to create some new mass, E equals MC squared. You have to do the same thing to make an antiproton. We use energy at a particle accelerator. It's a lower energy than the LHC, but we need the energy to create the mass in the antiproton. And, of course, we create proton-antiproton pairs. That's what the law tells us. But they're made in an accelerator, and that's why we have to be at CERN to make the antiprotons. Turns out you can buy positrons. You can get a radioactive source that's made, in this case, in South Africa, that just sits and emits positrons all day long. And then we have a device that accumulates them and stores them up.
Ah, quite interesting. I wish you good luck in
Thank
your
you.
Experiment.
Hope to be back soon.
Yeah, tell us when you do that gravity laser experiment. Or
yeah, okay.
Get it close to a good. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. Jeffrey Hanks, Professor of Physics at Aarhus University in Denmark. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about autism and all kinds of new research about it. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
To help keep these podcasts free, we need your support. Here's Anna to tell you how.
Thanks, Ira. This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by GoToMeeting.com, the award-winning web conferencing application for Macs and PCs. One of the ways business gets done these days is by bringing people together, sharing ideas, and collaborating. And more, the people you want to work with are across town, or on the other side of the country, or even around the world. So how can you help them make the best possible contribution to your business or project? It's simple. GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is the web conferencing tool which enables colleagues and clients from remote locations to see your computer desktop on their computer screen, which means you can collaborate from a distance, form closer relationships, and be more effective. Use GoToMeeting for virtual meetings, product demos and reviews, sales presentations, training sessions, and status updates, just about any type of meeting. You can schedule GoToMeetings in advance or hold them on the fly. Try GoToMeeting today and receive a free 30-day trial and help Science Friday, too. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click Try It Free, and enter the promo code SCIENCE. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code SCIENCE. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone. Now, back to the show.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. New important clues are emerging about one of the mysteries of the brain, autism. Today, about one in every 110 kids in the United States is estimated to have some sort of autism spectrum disorder, ASD. A slew of research papers published in the journal Neuron this week shows that autism may be a much more complex disorder than we had believed. Scientists have identified many more genetic mutations that appear to be associated with autism, some more likely to affect boys than girls, other mutations that may influence the very circuitry of the brain, and how neurons hook into one another. And some recent epidemiological studies have turned up some very surprising trends. An association between autism and conception in the winter months, or apparently lower risk of autism if mothers took prenatal vitamins at the time of conception, indicating that some of these autistic switches may be flipped on very early in our development. For the rest of the hour, we're going to review the latest research on the causes of autism and take a look at some of the best treatments out there, too. And you want to share what works for your kid, give us a call. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can tweet us at SciFry. And there up on our Spanish language site, we've got an interview on the genetics of autism with an author from one of those genetic papers. Check it out in Spanish at our Spanish.com/Spanish site. That's sciencefriday.com/Spanish site. Let me introduce my guest, Christopher Walsh, professor of pediatrics and neurology at Children's Hospital, Boston, and Harvard Medical School. He joins us from a studio on campus. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Walsh.
Hi, Ira. Great to be here.
Nice to have you. Rebecca Landa is a director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore. She joins us from WYPR. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Landa.
Hi, thank you. It's a pleasure.
You're very welcome. Irva Hertz-Picciotto is professor of epidemiology at the UC Davis Mind Institute, that's short for the Medical Investigation of Neurodevelopmental Disorders, and she's based in Sacramento. She joins us from the studios of Capital Public Radio. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Christopher Walsh, you were an author on one of the genetic studies in the journal Neuron. What do these three studies tell us about the role that genes play in autism?
Well, Ira, these studies add to earlier work showing that autism is very highly genetic. Some people want to run away from that and hide behind notions that autism is caused by vaccines or heavy metals or something, I think because they think of genetics as something unchangeable. But the second thing these studies show is that autism genetics is not immutable destiny, because some kids, girls especially, carry the same genetic hits that unquestionably raise the risk of autism but develop typically, meaning that the genetics is modifiable. And then finally, these papers show us that far from being untreatable, autism's genetic mechanisms suggest specific ways that people are already developing new drugs that hopefully in the long run will be able to treat it better.
Well, when you say that these are genes identified with these autism studies, that there's a lot of genetics involved. Are these the kinds of genes you would inherit from your parents, like you inherit a gene for eye color or things like that? Because wouldn't then the parents exhibit autism if it was transmitted that way?
Well, Ira, that's a great question. And because, as you say, we tend to think of genetic diseases as inherited diseases as almost two words for the same thing. But actually what these studies show is almost the opposite. When it comes to the mutations that cause autism, these studies were specifically designed on the hypothesis that autism might be caused by mutations that are not in the parents, that are not inherited, but are instead spontaneous mutations, analogous to the kinds of spontaneous mutations that might cause cancer. And so it seems like these spontaneous mutations are particularly common as a cause of autism.
Dr. Hertz-Picciotto, you recently published a study associating autism with the time of the year that a baby is conceived. Tell us about that.
Well, we have actually a large program looking at a lot of environmental factors, and the reason we took this on was because there's a bit of a literature in schizophrenia suggesting that the timing. In that case, they looked at season or month of birth and found, you know, some interesting patterns. And in general, by looking at seasonal patterns, we get clues about what sorts of factors we might want to pursue in greater depth. So in this particular study, we had data from the entire state of California. We were able to link millions of births over more than a decade, and which of those children had developed autism based on statewide service databases that we have. And what we found was that the mothers who had conceived their child in the summer months, were those children were at the lowest risk, and then the risks increased steadily. So that in the months of December through March, those conceptions were at the highest risk for autism. Now, I should add, though, that highest is not particularly higher than the lowest, where, in fact, it was, you know, somewhere between 8 and 15% or so increase over the background. So it's the difference between, say, 9 in 1,000 and maybe 10 or 10.5%. Cases per 1,000 births.
Any speculation why you'd have more babies conceived in March than, let's say, August having autism?
Right. Well, when you look around at, so what are the factors that vary by season? You know, the winter months are months of, you know, higher rates of infections. The winter, spring and summer can be months of, you know, higher use of certain kinds of you know, pest control products, both in agriculture and also around the home. And I should add that even though we were looking at month of conception, it might well be that the critical time, it might be around the time of conception for, you know, whatever factor that turns out to be, but it might also be, say, something that happens in month 3 or month 4 of gestation. So it's simply that there is a block of months in the year that at some point during that early development of the brain, there may be some factor that to which the, you know, some process in brain development is vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca Landa, as someone who has worked for years with kids with autism, tell us what the most successful therapeutic approaches are. How much can you overcome the effects of autism?
Well, it's surprisingly that you can actually overcome quite a bit, especially if you begin the interventions early in life. And so the main principles of intervention are to make things simple for the child, to reduce the options, if you will, for the kinds of responses that they make, and to create a lot of predictability. And so some of the labels for some of the interventions that achieve this are applied behavior analysis and some of the developmentally based interventions.
Mm-hmm. And what about the future? Are there any new interventions on the horizon?
Well, you know, there continue to be nuances in the interventions, just like Dr. Walsh was explaining, that with the genetics, with advances in the neurosciences, you have more and more technology to be able to look at genetic mechanisms. It's similar in the developmental sciences. So as we learn more about how the brain learns and what typically developing infants know at certain stages of their development, we can begin to apply those principles to trick the brain of children with autism into learning things that it otherwise wouldn't learn.
Mm-hmm. Christopher Walsh, you're saying there are many, many different genes associated with autism in the brain. Do you see some, though, some common mechanism at play, some common defect? Why do boys seem more susceptible to autism if they have certain mutations? Are you going to be able to narrow it down that we're all looking for those, you know, magic few genes, or is it going to be a constellation of genes all the time?
Well, I think it's probably going to be closer to the second answer, the idea of a constellation of genes. However, a large number of the genes we've identified seem to have common functions in the brain, focusing around the synapses that connect one brain cell to another. And therefore, that makes us very hopeful that we might be able to design additional treatments that might regulate the way these synapses function. And in fact, there's already clinical trials of drugs from several different companies that are actually targeting some of these genes that function specifically in these synaptic connections between brain cells, and they're showing some initial promise.
Can you get a little more detail about what's going on at the synapses there that's malfunctioning?
Sure. Yeah, the synapses are the point of connection between brain cells. And the brain allows us to learn and remember new things by systematically strengthening some synapses or weakening others the way you might sort of rewire a circuit. And when we experience something, this is represented in the brain as a sequence of electrical activity from one brain cell to another. And if the brain wants to remember that experience, the connection between two active brain cells is somehow strengthened in an amazingly specific fashion. So brain cells then have a mechanism that registers which cells are active, and then it turns on specific genes that are normally idle just for a few minutes or a few hours when the activity is present. And then these time-locked genes will specifically strengthen a particular synapses.
Mm. And in autism, what may be causing the defect?
Right. So it looks like this is a very complicated process that involves hundreds, maybe thousands of genes, and it increasingly looks like defects almost anywhere along that process might be sufficient to cause autism. So on the one hand, that can be a depressing thought, thinking maybe Sure. Do we need to design 1,000 drugs for 1,000 kids. However, in fact, recent research suggests that drugs that work for one kid might very well work for another kid with autism with a distinct genetic defect in much the same way that statins will treat high cholesterol, regardless of how we got there, whether it's one genetic defect or another genetic defect or just a dietary cause.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a couple of comments from our listeners. Let's go to Stephen in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
All right. I had some experience with autism in my family. And autism-related conditions. What we did was we did nutrition therapy, specifically mineral therapy. Basically, we did research into what the body was absorbing through sample tests for hair and so forth, and we started supplementing with a lot of magnesium, a lot of zinc. We used TMG, which is something that helps the body process those, and it had some dramatic effects.
Hmm. Dr. Landa, have you heard of this?
I would probably bounce that question back to Dr. Walsh.
Okay.
Can't say I'm specifically familiar with that work.
Okay. Thank you, Stephen, and good luck
to you.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we get another question here from Lynn in Southampton, Pennsylvania. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Hi. I have a 5-year-old son who's been thrown out of many schools and didn't start talking until very late due to autism and sensory issues. And I'm interested in, we decided not to go the drug route at this point. Didn't really know there was autism type drugs. Two questions. Can my embryos be tested? Because I had him in vitro, if I want to have another child and find out. And also, what kinds of non-drug or drug-related programs are you finding that are most effective?
Okay, thanks for calling. Let's see if we can get some answers here. Can you test the embryos for autism?
So when we have identified a specific genetic cause that's present in a particular family, then indeed the embryos can be tested. So for the benefit of this caller, what we would have to do would be to have to get her hooked up with a research program to identify the specific genetic cause associated with her son's condition. And for that, I would recommend that she contact the Simons Foundation or the Autism Genetic Resource Exchange, where she might be able to get herself involved in these studies, which I encourage everyone to do.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. We're talking about autism this hour. Dr. Hertz-Picciotto, another recent study you released linked a lower risk for autism to prenatal vitamin intake. Tell us about that, please.
Yes, this is a study where we had a group of group of mothers whose child had autism and a similar group of mothers whose child was developing typically. All of the children were between the ages of 2 and 5, and we collected a vast array of information about their behaviors, their exposures, their medication history, their reproductive history, and so forth. And one of the questions we asked pertained to their intake of prenatal vitamin supplements. And for many of these questions, we really made a concerted effort to find out the timing of the behaviors or the timing of the exposures. So we asked them, when did they start taking those prenatal vitamin supplements, and when did they, did they take them throughout the pregnancy and so forth? Well, the results showed that the mothers of children who had autism were less likely to have reported that they took those prenatal vitamin supplements in the 3 months prior to conception and also in the first month after conception. And the reduction in risk for those who did take them was almost 40%, suggesting that something going on very early, pre-conception or right around the time of conception, might be involved in autism. And I think this links interestingly with, of course, the results that Dr. Walsh has been talking about regarding the spontaneous or sporadic de novo, copy number variants and so forth that are being seen in the genome.
Let me repeat that again, because that went by quickly. Women who took prenatal vitamins had a 40% lower risk of children with autism.
Yes, and it was the more frequently they took them, in other words, the higher the dose they were getting, mm-hmm. the stronger that effect was.
At the time of conception, if they were taking these vitamins, 40% were lower risk. Wow.
Right.
And you'd think, wow.
So those vitamins contain, high levels of folic acid, as well as some other B vitamins. The reasons women take those is because that is the public health and medical recommendation. The reason being that we know that high levels of folic acid protect against what are called neural tube defects. This is a congenital malformation where the primordial brain doesn't quite develop appropriately. One of the results is, for instance, it's called spina bifida. So that's why women would have been taking them, because that is what is recommended. This is interesting because it's that same time period that seems relevant for autism.
Wow. Oh, very interesting. Stay with us because we have lots more to talk about. New data about autism. We'll be right back after this short break. Don't go away.
You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the causes of autism. More and more genes are being linked to the disorder, as is gender, environmental factors, month of conception. We're hearing about vitamins, women taking vitamins at the time of conception being a reduction in risk factor. Great medical mysteries here with my guest, Christopher Walsh, professor of pediatrics and neurology, Children's Hospital Boston and Harvard Med School. Rebecca Landa, director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore. Irva Hertz-Picciotto, professor of epidemiology, UC Davis Mind Institute in Sacramento. Number 1-800-999-8255. Dr. Hertz-Picciotto, you did a study last year on the age of parents as related to the risk of autism. And it was interesting that you found that that it depended on how young the mother was, particularly. Correct?
Right. Yes, there's been debate about whether it's age of the mother or age of the father. We certainly are seeing pretty consistently that at least one of those does predict a higher risk of autism in the offspring. In our study, we actually had again, similar to the month of conception study, the entire database of all the births in California. So we were able to disentangle a little bit the mother and the father's contribution, which it's very hard to do because, of course, they tend to correlate. So a small data set is not really going to be able to separate out which of those it is very effectively. But we found that the father's age was not important if the mother was over 30. Of course, the mother's age being over 30 was itself a risk factor. But when the mother was under 30, that's when the father's age seemed to make a difference.
A mother under 30 and a father 40, let's say, or...
Yeah, exactly. That seemed to be, the father's age in that case seemed to elevate the risk. Father age 40 as opposed to a father age, 25 for a mother of the same age under 30.
Very interesting. Dr. Landa, there are lots of alternative therapies out there. Gluten-free diets, swimming with dolphins, stuff like that. What do you tell parents who want to try out things like that?
Right, and you can't blame parents for wanting to try these things because there's a lot of reports on the internet about miracle cures. The important thing is for parents to keep in mind are two major principles. One, if you decide to do those things, continue with the evidence-based interventions. And two, be very careful about the ones that can cause harm to your child. So it's important for things like if you do choose something like chelation, which takes all the metals out of the bloodstream, and some of those metals are important for good health, you have to really have a good reason for doing that. And if you're going to follow one of the diet therapies, then you want to make sure that you are in close touch with a dietitian or a health professional to make sure the child is getting the proper nutrients.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Dr. Walsh, with this new knowledge about all these genes that are involved, what do you do next? What's the next steps in your research or anyone's research in the genetics of it?
Well, what these studies published this week did was really look to make sure all the genes were there in the right amounts. We ordinarily have two copies of each of our genes, and these studies were really a very careful inventory to make sure we had two of all the genes we were supposed to have two of, instead of having only one or instead of having too much of something. So you can think of it as like taking an inventory of the books in a library and making sure all this stuff was there, and we found that a certain number of kids were missing stuff or had extra genes sitting around that actually caused problems. But what we haven't done yet is take down those genes one by one and open them up and read them and check them for typographical errors or pages missing. And that's the sort of information you get from sequencing the whole genome, because each one of those genes is like a book. And you have to check all the letters to make sure, because surprisingly, these little typographical errors in a gene, which are called point mutations, are usually sufficient to inactivate the whole gene and make it no darn good. And so that's really the next step, is to use this fast DNA sequencing to examine these genes one by one. And we think we'll find a lot more autism-related mutations that way. And in fact, there's already one or two papers that have come out recently on that subject that suggest that this high-throughput sequencing will help us explain a lot more of the genetic contribution of autism.
1-800-989-8255. Terry in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Terry.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a son who was diagnosed at 4 with Asperger's syndrome. He's now 17. I knew something was up when he was 18 months old. To me, the best thing that helped my son was my being his number one advocate and learning as much as I could. He was on medication therapy early on. He had a lot of sensory issues, speech issues. He was taking risperidol and Luvox and Concerta and a lot of things, and we found that he was having hallucinations reportedly. But, it's difficult with these kids because they can't really communicate very well. He's come a long, long way. He doesn't have as many sensory issues, but for me, the thing that really seemed to work for him was my vigilance, my insistence on including him in as many things as I could possibly get him into, speech therapy, occupational therapy, and although he was a bit early to get ABA, behavioral therapy, that would have benefited him. But and I know it's genetic in this case on the paternal side. Also did a lot of research into the family side and found that the autism goes back into other family members, autistic disorders of the high-functioning type. But
all right.
Anyway, to me, the medication is questionable, and I didn't go for any of the diets because I knew that it was genetic for one thing, although I might add that I know that some of the members who have some of the autistic features did have some type of a intolerance to certain foods. but I'm not sure how they adjusted their diets, but I don't think that caused the autism.
All right, Terry, I got to run, but thank you for your comments.
Sure.
Dr. Landa, any comments on what Terry had to say?
Well, I really take her point, and that is that parents really do need to apprise themselves of what the evidence-based treatments are, and they do know their children better than anyone else. And so, you know, when they start to notice these signs of developmental disruption in their children, they really have to persist if they have a sense that their child's not developing well, and see a developmental expert and also physicians to make sure there's no known medical cause that can be treated for the problem, for autism. And then, you know, they have to aggressively seek the interventions. Like she mentioned, she had her child in early intervention, and that's just pivotal.
How early? Let me ask all three of you. I've got about a minute left. How early can you check your child for autism? How early can you catch it? How early can you intervene?
Well, the signs of developmental disruption can be present during infancy, but they're nonspecific for autism. You can start to diagnose it around the time of the first birthday, but some children don't begin to show the symptoms until after that. So, you know, you just have to have ongoing screening for children over time.
Do you agree, Dr. Walsh?
Yeah, I agree completely that early on it's a nonspecific diagnosis. One of the most important aspects of diagnosing it is trouble with language. And, of course, since that usually doesn't develop until age two, it makes it difficult to diagnose it sooner than that. And it's not like, you know, we have an X-ray test or a blood test for it. And that would be the hope that in the long run perhaps we could diagnose kids that were at higher risk so that we could intervene earlier and better.
And what – I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, children are really communicating at the 9-month mark in development. So they're starting to point and gesture and to form words. And so, you know, when those things aren't present at between 9 to 12 months, there should be some concern.
And what's the first thing a parent should do besides get, you know, panicky?
Well, they don't need to panic. I mean, they really do need to tell a professional. That person can be their pediatrician. It can also be a developmental person in the, what's called the 0 to 3 or early intervention programs, where they can get free developmental assessments for their children.
And they know where to find these. They should deal with their pediatrician. Pediatrician will send them to specialists or different organizations.
Well, not necessarily. Pediatricians don't always make referrals. Sometimes they take a wait-and-see attitude. So, but if parents remain concerned, they should contact their Infants and Toddlers program or 0 to 3. It has a different name in different states in the U.S., but it is free, and they can get good assessments there.
Are there support groups for parents that you'd recommend?
Yes, I mean, there's the Autism Society of America, and there's Autism Speaks and some other advocacy organizations. And so they can look up either autismspeaks.org, or they can look up the Autism Society of America, and they can find out the local chapters in their area.
And Dr. Hertz-Picciotto, what about the rest of the family? Does autism affect non-autistic siblings? Should you be concerned about that?
I think the family environment is totally modified by having a child who has a disability of this sort. Often the children who are unaffected lose out on a lot of parental attention. So within the home, you know, there's an entire dynamic amongst the different family members that, you know, can have problematic effects on all of the members of the family. My work is focused more on the earlier issues of whether the underlying causes. And, you know, people worry also when they're thinking of having another child about what might go wrong. And we do know that siblings do have a higher risk for autism in subsequent children. So those are concerns I know that affect families as well. And you know, I do want to say, in terms of this issue of genetics and environment, is that it's not an either-or situation. I think genes and environment interact in multiple ways. And one example, you know, I was talking earlier about the prenatal supplements. We did find that there are women who have certain genetic profiles that put them at higher risk for those women who are not taking the supplements, such that in a certain case, certain gene, one case in the child and one case in the mother, if the mother didn't take the supplements, that child was at 4 to 7-fold higher risk for having autism. So we've got to be looking, I think, not just at opening up the book, as Dr. Walsh pointed out, within the genes, but also starting to link the two, figuring out how those two operate together. And then we should be able to give some guidance for prevention, even, you know, as early as before the pregnancy, during the pregnancy, as well as come up with ways to intervene, you know, after the child is born or showing symptoms.
I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us. Christopher Walsh, Professor of Pediatrics and Neurology, Children's Hospital Boston, Harvard Med School. Rebecca Landa, Director of the Center for Autism and Related Disorders at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore. Dr. Erverhits Picciotto is a professor of epidemiology at the UC Davis Mind Institute in Sacramento. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ira.
I'm Ira Flatow. Thanks. This is Science Friday from NPR. Here with us now, Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor. Hi, Flora. Got
Hi,
a video
Ira.
Pick of the week?
Yes, this week's video pick of the week is about growing tissues in the laboratory. Locally grown. We saw some locally grown heart.
Not Kleenex.
The other type of tissues. Organs, bones. Actually, this lab at Columbia University here in New York focuses on heart muscle and bones. They can grow bones in the
you
lab.
You saw them grow bones and hearts.
And they also do blood vessels. So I just want to get all their things
it's
out
like,
there.
You know, body parts.
They do body parts in the lab. It's pretty amazing. So in this incubator, you walk into the lab and it sort of looks like a normal lab. There are beakers and the lab bench. And then in the corner, there are these little things that look sort of like a mini fridge. But you open it up, and there's beating heart muscle just beating along that they have cultured themselves. And they start with a few different types of cells. So sometimes they work with human embryonic stem cells and sort of coax them into becoming heart muscle. And other times they start with rat heart cells and then kind of disassociate them from the rat heart and then make them come back together and make this piece of beating muscle.
Are they trying to create the whole heart or just parts of it? Or
no, they're really – this lab, and it's Gordana Vanyak Novakovic, although I'm sure she would pronounce it differently, is really focused on making heart patches. And the idea is that if you have a piece of heart that dies because of heart disease, you could just sort of stick it on. And the nice thing about working with human embryonic stem cells is that if you're using reprogrammed stem cells, for example, you could use it from someone's skin, reprogram it, turn it into a stem cell, and then turn it into heart muscle. That's far away. We're not there yet.
Not there yet. And if you go to see Flora's video on our website at sciencefriday.com, up there in the video pick of the week on the left, and you look at the video and you can actually, this is amazing, you can watch the hearts. It's not, the hearts are just pieces of heart, but they're beating together.
It's contracting. I mean, this is kind of
the
cells in unison are beating together and they're hooked up. They're in a petri dish, but you'll notice immediately that there are alligator clips and two electrodes in the petri dish. So it's not your normal petri dish, right? And it's attached to this little box where you can change the voltage coming in and the cycles per second. So they actually can turn the dial and the heart rate of these cells will go up or down. It's really, really
It matches the electrical current beat.
Yeah, the Hertz cycle.
Wow.
So 3 beats per second is sort of the resting heart rate of a rat. And so they like to, but you can turn it down to 1. It really was an obedient little creature. I thought it was a little scary. When I mentioned it to the researchers, they disagreed. But
yeah, your video pick has a little bit of Frankenstein in it there.
Yeah, well, when I was thinking about this, you know, galvanism, this idea of stimulating muscles was what inspired Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein. So, yes, I make the comparison, although they are not raising the dead. They are not rummaging through graveyards. It's really not. It's a little bit of a stretch, I admit.
There's no Gene Wilder involved.
And the lead researcher will not remind you of Gene Wilder.
Frankenstein. Oh, thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Sarah.
And it's Flora Lichtman's video pick of the week up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. And it's up there, and you can see it at our website, along with all the other video picks to pick of the weeks. And we'll wait to see the next one. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks.
Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.